This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good evening. My name is Nigella Hilgarth, and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And welcome to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science speaker series. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. James Day. James was born in Denmark and has actually lived all over the UK, Denmark, and Belgium. In fact, he wanted me to tell you that he moved 20 times. And he got his schooling in the county of Kent, in fact, King's School, Canterbury. And he went to university at the great University of Durham and got a Bachelor of Science first class in geology. And he also stayed, as actually is the custom in Europe, he stayed and did his PhD in geochemistry at the University of Durham in studies to understand the mantle geochemistry of the Earth. And then he moved to the University of Tennessee as a postdoc to work on lunar samples. What's cooler than that? And then he went to the University of Maryland as a postdoctoral research associate and then as a research scientist. And he was there for 4 years before he came to Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he's been here since 2010 as an assistant professor. And he teaches field methods and petrology, and he's the founder and director of the Scripps Isotope Geochemistry Laboratory. And his interests are broadly in geochemistry and cosmochemistry, with a special emphasis on planetary formation and differentiation processes and questions of our origins. Very, very cool stuff. And please welcome me, if I can find the name here, in James's talk this evening, which is Making the Earth's Moon. I've been excited about this talk all day, so please join me in welcoming James.
Well, thank you, Nigella, and thank you for coming out tonight and listening to me talk. And I'd just like to say a special mention to a very special guest, Simona Rudemans, who's come to hear my talk. I think she's the youngest person in the room tonight, but you're all very, very welcome. So I'm going to talk about making the Earth's moon. And before I get into the grit of the talk, I just wanted to break down the talk structure for you. This is a picture from the Apollo 8 mission that circled the moon, showing the Earth's moon and the Earth from afar. It's one of the most evocative pictures from the Apollo missions, and in my view, is a great example of why we should explore planetary bodies, just to understand our own. I'll start with an introduction, a little bit about myself and my laboratory here at Scripps. And then I'm going to get into aspects of what the moon is made of, and what processes on Earth can tell us about the moon. And finally, how and when did the moon form? The take-home messages from this talk are simple. The moon formed late and most likely in a cataclysmic impact with the Earth. Complete melting led to a distinct layered geology of the moon, which is very important for understanding compositions of rocks that come from the moon. And the moon is dry with possible wet regions, and this makes it very, very different from Earth. This image here is taken, this is me in the Antarctic. This is called a sundog. It's a halo of ice formed from the sun reflecting, refracting off ice particles. And what I wanted to get across here is that we have ice and we have oceans on our planet. How did these come about? Where does the water come from? A thing that's such a necessity for life. So a little bit about my laboratory. I came here in 2010 and I began the Scripps Isotope Geochemistry Laboratory. It's actually enhancing a long tradition of geochemistry, of understanding the Earth's interior and planets at Scripps, and really for understanding our origins. And this is just some examples of the instrumentation we have coming in, actually, very recently coming into our laboratory to understand the chemistry of rocks and other media, from oceans to biological medium in our new laboratory. It's very exciting times. And it's wouldn't run without my the people who work in my lab and who I'm proud to say I collaborate with, my postdoc, Chris Waters, many of the students who work in my lab, Brad Peters, Jasmeet Dhaliwal, Caitlin Traver, Jorge Perez, Chris Corda, Damien Nelson, and Bridget Giza. And these are the people who really drive the research that I'm going to present. So what do we do? Well, ultimately, the big question is, how do you form and then subsequently transform planets? And the major questions we want to address are, when did the planets form and from what materials? And this schematic diagram here, A, B, and C, shows broadly nebula cloud accreting to form our solar system. The cloud of dust and gas began to accrete and clump along a plane, the plane of the ecliptic, and formed the sun and obviously the planets that orbit the sun. And then subsequently, those individual planets began to differentiate. That means that they began to break down and potentially melt into iron-rich cores, such as the Earth has, silicate mantles, again, such as the Earth, and then crusts, and in some case, hydrospheres and atmospheres. How did this all come about? And what do these tell us about the histories of planets, and more importantly, about our own solar system? And finally, what makes the Earth so special? Where did the water come from on the Earth? And what are the conditions that led to our dynamic planet today? And hopefully, the discussion about the moon today will give you some idea of where we're going in answering these questions. So just to give you an idea of what we do, we talk about making, relating, and dating planets. Here's just some examples of the type of rocks we use. These are transmitted polarized light images with scales shown of different planetary rocks. In A, this is a Brachianite. This is a rock that is believed to come from an asteroid. These in B and C are diogenites. These are thought to come from the asteroid Vesta, which is the current research point of the Dawn mission. And then finally, this rock here is a xenolith, or a foreign rock from the Canary Islands. And what you'll notice, all of these rocks look different to your eye, but they're all composed of olivine. This is the main constituent of the Earth's mantle. It's a magnesium iron silicate. And these rocks can tell us a huge amount about the history of planets. In one example, A here, the Brachianites, this is a model that I generated recently for how the Brachianite parent body, an asteroid, potentially looks inside. And based on these rocks, we can tell that the body formed a small, early formed core, or nascent core, a silicate mantle, and a crust, just like the Earth. But this body didn't go to completion. It didn't completely melt. And understanding why these bodies didn't completely melt is a major goal of our research. We also look at the Earth's mantle and crust. And we look at rocks from different parts of the planet. This is one example. Caitlin Traver, my student, in Fuerteventura in the Canary Islands. And these are Jurassic, 180-million-year-old sediments that have been uplifted in Fuerteventura, cross-cut by igneous dikes of basaltic material, and then subsequently overlain by sediments. And this really preserves a lot of evidence about how the Canary Islands and other oceanic islands form. And these are important because we know that the Earth is convecting. We have plate tectonics where you create new plate material at mid-ocean ridges. You then drive it towards zones of destruction or subduction zones, where you subsequently throw down that material into the mantle. And the fate, the ultimate fate of that material, is shown as these question marks. And really, we don't understand what happens to it, but our basic understanding to date is that it returns in places like oceanic islands. And this is very important for understanding the heat transfer within the mantle of the Earth and how water is taken back down into the Earth's mantle. And this is funded by the National Science Foundation and most recently the San Diego Foundation. And what I discovered in my travels is one thing about the mantle, and that's that you don't mess with it. This is a piece of rock. It doesn't look very interesting, from the island of Leka in Norway. It's a piece of mantle that's thought to have been thrown up onto the Earth's crust in Norway. And what I discovered walking across it is it really is pretty hard stuff. So don't mess with the mantle. We're also interested in the consequences of massive volcanism and the causes of massive volcanism. And this has taken place across Earth history in a number of locations, specifically the Deccan Traps in India and the Siberian Traps in Russia. These two locations are areas where huge amounts and outpourings of basaltic lava have taken place. In the case of the Deccan Traps, about 65 million years ago, and in case of the Siberian Traps, at the Permo-Triassic boundary. The Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary also occurs at 65 million years, and both of these locations are thought to have had profound effects on the atmosphere and the composition of the atmosphere. So understanding what these events mean and how they occur, and also what they put into the atmosphere, is very important for understanding the extinction events that happened at those two important time boundaries. And this is another area of our research, and it's supported by National Geographic. So anyway, going to the talk for today, the origin of the moon. The moon has been central to the human race since the earliest records. The word moon comes from the Germanic and Indo-European word root of me or measure. And this is apt because the moon is in synchronous rotation with the Earth. That means to say the orbit of the moon exactly matches its rotation, such that you always see one side of the moon, the near side. And Galileo, in his early work using his telescopes, did beautiful diagrams of the moon, showing the moon's face at different times in the waxing and waning and the lunar cycles. He showed that there were lunar librations where, in fact, you can see about 60% of the moon's surface. And this is because the orbit of the moon is not completely circular. It's slightly elliptical. And the consequence of this is that the moon wobbles slightly during these rotations. The moon has also been the subject of divine worship. And most beautifully decorated are these examples from Greek mythology: Selene, which means brightness, the god of the moon, and Luna, which is the Latin equivalent. And the moon has been fundamental to many religions, many cultures, because of the profound effects it has on periodicity on the Earth. The moon has also been subject to understanding how it formed from the very first example of what the composition of the moon is. The moon is made of green cheese. John Hayward, sadly, was shown to be wrong about 400 years after he wrote his Proverbs. And this came about because of the return of lunar samples from the moon by the Apollo missions by the USA and the lunar missions by the USSR. Coming back to Galileo, Galileo defined the basic geologic units of the moon. He defined the terrae, or the highlands of the moon, which are these light, high albedo areas that cover two-thirds of the near side lunar surface and almost all of the far side, the side we don't see on Earth. And then he defined the maria, or the seas, that were these dark, low albedo regions that he suggested were, as I say, seas and oceans. And his understanding of the moon remains today. The dichotomy in these two regions, a key to our understanding of the geology and origin of the Moon. The Moon is also anomalous because it's one of the largest satellites in our solar system. If you discount Charon, which is the satellite of Pluto, or the pair of Pluto, which is a dwarf planet, the Earth is the largest moon in our solar system. It's 1/80th the Earth's mass, and this has always been a subject of great interest, because how do you form a moon of this size? So that question can be addressed in what's the moon made of, and what processes on Earth can tell us about the moon. So coming back to the samples, the first samples brought back from the moon occurred in this incredible event, the Apollo 11 landing on the 20th of July 1969. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon. They were orbited by Michael Collins, and sadly, Neil Armstrong passed away last year, but he left a great legacy along with Buzz Aldrin and the other pioneers of the Apollo program. Not only did they leave the first footsteps on the moon, they landed in the Sea of Tranquility and they collected the first rocks. They were subsequently followed by five other successful Apollo missions: the Apollo 12 mission to the Ocean of Storms, the Apollo 14 mission to Frau Mauro, the Apollo 15 mission to Hadley Rill, the Apollo 16 mission to the Descartes Highlands, and finally the Apollo 17 mission to Taurus Littoro. These missions all tried to sample distinct geology on the moon, and they did that very successfully, as I hopefully will show you. These missions occurred from 1969 all the way through till 1972, December 1972, over 40 years ago. These missions have also been enhanced by robotic missions by the USSR, starting in about 1970 with the Luna 16 mission and ending in 1976 with the Luna 24 mission. Although these didn't bring back as much material, the material they brought back is extremely invaluable. There's roughly 382 kilograms of lunar material, and that material comes from these nine sites. And those nine sites, if you're optimistic and argue that they form this shape here, cover 9% of the lunar surface. In reality, they cover less than a fraction of a percent. The collection methods the astronauts used were simple. They either used grab holders like this to pick up rocks, and then they used, in later missions, buggies to get further away from their modules. And what they collected was quite startling. They collected volcanic rocks from the Mare regions, the dark low albedo regions. They collected rocks that were full of a mineral called plagioclase from the highlands regions. And they collected glasses. And the scale here is about a millimeter across. Beautiful glasses that are still pristine, glassy material that are over 4 billion years old from the Apollo 15 and 17 missions. This is the Apollo 74220 sample. It's a high titanium basaltic glass, and it's unique to the moon. You don't find anything like it on this planet. Curation at NASA continues to this day, and this is the NASA Johnson Space Center, and our able curators and myself looking out of place and rather pallid, actually, in the background. It's all very white, and I seem to blend in quite well. But the curation occurs in these hoods here, and all of the samples, that 382 kilograms, is preserved in a big vault just behind us, actually. All of the samples are preserved in nitrogen to try and preserve, as best as we can, their lunar characteristics. Other samples we have available to us come as meteorites, and these fall as accidental samples that land in the hot desert regions and also in the cold desert regions, such as the Antarctic. Here's just some of the locations that the US Antarctic meteorite collection groups have used. Here's the South Pole, and just down here somewhere, just here is Ross Island and McMurdo Base. And the meteorites fall on the Antarctic ice, and they're brought down from the South Pole as the ice moves towards the ocean. They reach the transantarctic mountains just here, and the ice has nowhere to go. And the wind, the adiabatic winds that come down from the pole, ablate that ice. And in the blue ice regions, just like here, you get immense concentrations of meteorites from all over our solar system. This is one of the most valuable resources for understanding processes that take place in our solar system. And what you can see here is this is actually a lunar meteorite. It's a La Paz meteorite, came from the La Paz ice field, which is just here. And you can see a dark black fusion crust. This is where it's fallen through the Earth's atmosphere. Friction heating has melted the exterior of the meteorite. This is what it looks like when you're collecting. It's almost like praying to an object. It's cold and it's tedious and painful work, but it's extremely worthwhile. And as you can see, we're ecstatic when we find one, because after 2 months of being on the ice and walking around just seeing white, seeing a black object makes you very, very happy. Finding the meteorites can be quite difficult, and certainly in the moraine regions. And this is just an example of one meteorite, and hopefully most of you can spot the meteorite. Can any of you spot the meteorite? Perhaps, can anyone explain what it... Go ahead. Tell me which way. Exactly. Shiny, it has a fusion crust. This is an ordinary chondrite. This is thought to make up the bulk of our solar system. It makes up around 85% of all the meteorites found. And lunar meteorites make up a tiny fraction. We have somewhere in the region of 60 lunar meteorites, but they're extremely valuable because they come from regions of the moon that the Apollo missions didn't go to. And so consequently, those meteorites allow us to get a much more global picture. Now, obviously, collecting meteorites from rocks from across the moon's surface by hand, by robotic missions, would be much better. But this is what we have to work with. This is what the rocks look like under a microscope. And all of these pictures are made with transmitted light passing through the rock. These are extremely thin slices of rock, about 30 microns thick. And we've used a polarizer to focus the light. And what you can see here, the scale on all of the lengths are about 2.4 millimeters. What we can see here, this is a rock from the Apollo 16 mission, and it's full of this white mineral. This is plagioclase. It's called an orthite. And the rock is called an anorthosite. And this is what makes up the high albedo regions of the moon. These two rocks, the rock in the top right corner, is from the Apollo 17 mission. And this is a high titanium basalt. It's full of minerals called ilmenite and armalcoite. Ilmenite is an iron titanium oxide mineral, and it's these dark patches here. And armalcoite is also an iron titanium oxide mineral. It has a slightly different structure. And armalcoite is one of the most interesting minerals because it's named after Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. Armalcoite. It was first detected in Apollo 11 samples and subsequently has been found on the Earth. This rock is actually the La Paz basalt meteorite I showed you. And this is one of the youngest samples we have from the moon. And I'll explain to you why we think this is from the moon, why we know it's from the moon. And this has this is a low titanium basalt. It has low amounts of titanium, much less of these minerals that are enriched in titanium and iron. And these three really encompass how we know the geology of the moon, as I'm about to explain. So just to come back, those basalts I showed you on the right-hand corner come from the Mario regions of the moon. These dark regions. And the white, bright sample I showed you on the left comes from the highlands regions, or the Terrae of Galileo. And in 1970, after the first Apollo 11 rocks came back, two groups, one led by Wood and one led by Smith, discovered small pieces of these plagioclase-rich materials in the Apollo 11 rocks. And they quickly realized that the Surveyor missions, which were robotic missions that landed on the moon and crudely measured the composition of rocks from regions of the moon they landed, had come up with bulk compositions that were identical or nearly identical to the composition of these small pieces, 200 microns is for scale, so this is only half a millimeter, of plagioclase-rich rock they found from the Apollo 11 missions. And they reasoned that the only way you could do this across the entire highlands regions of the moon was if you had some massive event that melted the moon and allowed plagioclase to be concentrated in the highlands crust. And they reasoned that this would have most likely occurred through flotation of plagioclase. Plagioclase is buoyant in the moon at certain conditions over a large body of magma. And this idea, which was initially met with shock, has stood the test of time. The idea is simple. What they want to happen is for a completely molten moon and for that moon to begin to crystallize and cool. And as it cools, mafic minerals, these are things like olivine that make up the Earth's mantle. Olivine is an iron, magnesium-rich silicate. They begin to form and they sink because they're dense in the bulk composition nor melt of the moon. And after a certain time, those minerals cease to crystallize. There's not enough magnesium, there's not enough iron around. And the amount of calcium and aluminium increases in the melt. And it just so happens that plagioclase is a calcium-aluminium silicate. And that begins to form, and this is much more buoyant. So it acts like a life vest or a life raft in the ocean. It just bobs up to the surface. And if you do this with sufficient quantities, you can generate an entire crust for a planet made of this material. And I say it stood the test of time because orbital missions of the moon using remote sensing from satellites has shown that the moon has a very strong structure geochemically. I'm showing you here iron contents based on lunar orbital data, but I could also show you thorium contents and various other compositions. This shows it quite nicely, though. The highlands region, the terai, it's shown vastly in blue. This is the far side, almost completely blue. And this is the near side, two-thirds of it blue. And the blue corresponds to very low iron oxide compositions. The yellow and the warm colors stand for the Maria regions, that dark, low albedo region. And those are iron-rich. And these match very well with what we think happened to the moon. We think that basically you had flotation of plagioclase that covered the entire surface of the moon, and then very large impacts that struck and broke through the crust, allowing melting of the lunar interior that's rich in iron, magnesium-rich silicates, that then formed the basaltic regions of volcanism that formed the Maria today. This is what the internal structure is thought to look like very crudely. We have early formed iron, magnesium silicates, olivine and orthopyroxene. Orthopyroxene is an iron magnesium silicate. Clinopyroxene, it has a bit of aluminium in it, but otherwise is very, and calcium, is very similar to orthopyroxene. And then we have the formation of the feldspathic crust that floats. And then at some stage in the process, we have the formation of ilmenite, iron, titanium oxide. And then finally, the very late stage material is full of incompatible elements, elements that don't want to go into minerals. And those elements form a layer that we know as creep. That's a potassium phosphorus rare earth element layer. Rare earth elements include things like lanthanum, ytterbium, and they are incompatible. And this region is thought to exist primarily because we see and detect compositions in some of the lavas that broke through possible surface layers on their way to the crust. And the Mare basalt data we have, these volcanic rocks that we think came from impacts striking the moon, breaking the moon's crust, and subsequently melting the interior of the moon, match very well with the compositions and structure of the moon we think we see today. This is a plot, and I'm not going to show you many XY plots. I only think I have three. This is one of them. It's magnesium versus titanium. And really what I want you to see is that there's two envelopes. There's high titanium Mare basalts, like that Apollo 17 basalt I showed you, and low titanium basalts. And these correspond very well to regions of the moon we think have this layered structure. So all of the compositions we see in those three images I showed you of anorthosite and basalts fit very well with our understanding of the geological structure of the moon. And this has great similarities to bodies we see on the Earth. So on Earth, we have intrusions of magma, where magma is generated in the mantle. It comes up through buoyancy, and they situate themselves in the Earth's crust, and they crystallize. And during that crystallization process, they crystallize out into olivine-rich rocks, olivine and plagioclase-rich, and then plagioclase-rich rocks. And an example of this is the Rum intrusion in Scotland. This is just one intrusion we work on in our group, but we also work on other intrusions in Montana, Canada, South Africa. And these intrusions also have a layered structure, and we think these are very good approximations for what we would see in the moon. And just so you believe me, this is the layering we see in the Rum intrusion. And you can see these very strongly layered rocks. These are bands of plagioclase and pyroxene. And here we have bands of olivine, this sort of rusty-looking stuff, and plagioclase. These are crystallizing out separately. They're settling or they're floating. Now, in the case of intrusions like the Rum intrusion, we see plagioclase coming out at certain times, forming these nice defined layers. In the moon, we think it came out in a wholesale event that was on a global scale. It formed a crust for the moon that's roughly 60 kilometers thick. This was a huge event. So how do you explain the massive amounts of heat and energy required to do that? And, you know, when did this take place? When did the moon form its layered structure? Was it just before we arrived on the planet? Or was it 4.5 billion years ago? And there are a number of other puzzles about the moon, and that's that the moon really has a tiny core of metal, possibly metal. We're not really sure what the composition of the moon's core is. It has a much higher iron content in its mantle than the Earth. And on top of all this, the moon has a much lower mass, of average mass of material than the Earth. The average density of the moon is about 3.3 grams per meter cubed. And that's about centimeter cubed, which is about 33% less than the Earth. Why is this? And I'll point out that the Earth's core is about 33% of the Earth. So how and when did the moon form? Well, the key here is the formation of the moon. This can really explain to us why the moon has its composition and when the moon formed. There are four main hypotheses. The first is the fission hypothesis, and that posits that the formation of the moon came from the Earth. The moon literally came out of the Earth's mantle. And the second hypothesis, and I'll talk about each of these hypotheses and their weaknesses and strengths. The second hypothesis is co-accretion, and that's that the moon formed at the same time as the Earth, the very beginning of the solar system, as a ring of low-density silicate debris. The third hypothesis is the capture hypothesis, and that's that the moon was just floating around and was captured into the orbit with the Earth. And then the final hypothesis is the giant impact hypothesis, the idea that the Earth and moon formed in a huge cataclysmic collision at some stage in the history of the solar system. The fission hypothesis is a particularly interesting one. It was devised by George Darwin in 1879, son of Charles Darwin. He proposed that the formation of the moon occurred from the terrestrial mantle. And at the time, he argued that it came from the Pacific region. And this was based, we might chuckle at this today, but he based it on the rough similarity in size between the moon and the Pacific. Of course, we now know that the Pacific and other oceanic plates are very young, and they formed via plate tectonic processes, the creation of plate at mid-ocean ridge systems that run all the way through the Atlantic, all the way through the central Indian region, and all the way into the Pacific, actually along this region here. About 80,000 kilometers of mountainous region beneath the oceans creates new plate that generates our oceanic basins. And that plate is destroyed at boundaries between continents and also between other oceanic plates. George Darwin didn't know this, but the idea is a very interesting one. And for some time, the model has been abandoned because it's been suggested the chemical differences between the Earth and Moon are too large to be explained by this process. It's been hard to explain the angular momentum and the lack of equatorial orbit between the Moon. The Moon doesn't orbit along the equator of the Earth, as it should if this was to occur. And as I say, the Pacific fits into the general theory of plate tectonics. But to keep you up to date on this, there was a paper that just came out 2 weeks ago where a group in Amsterdam argues that, in fact, there was a large nuclear explosion at the core mantle boundary. This is because of physics that occurs in the Earth very early in its history, and that this could actually generate the fission hypothesis. So this might be being resurrected. And it does broadly fit some of the geochemical data I'll show you. But I think that this hypothesis is still has a great question mark over it, despite its novelty. The co-accretion hypothesis is that the formation of the Earth and Moon occurred as a double planetary system. And this is essentially where you have materials being added to make larger and larger planets, like a snowball effect. But instead of making a single snowball, i.e. the Earth, bits of them went into the Earth, and bits of them orbited to form the Earth's moon. And this model has almost certainly been abandoned. It doesn't really attain the angular momentum we see between the Earth and moon, the way that they orbit one another. And it doesn't explain this lack of equatorial orbit. And as I'll show, it really doesn't explain the geochemistry of the moon very well at all. The final hypothesis before the giant impact is the capture hypothesis. And this was a really popular hypothesis before the Apollo missions landed. Harold Urey, who is based here in UCSD, who is one of the founding fathers of it, suggested that this was a valid hypothesis. And the idea is that you captured the moon. And this has happened on many solar system bodies. Phobos and Deimos, which are tiny moons of Mars, are captured asteroids. Certain moons around certain Jovian, Saturnian systems may very well have been captured. It's not the case with the moon. Despite these very well-known scientists coming up with ideas for capture, this really doesn't explain many of the physical parameters of the Earth-Moon system, and it really doesn't explain the chemistry of the moon either. The model that has gained the most traction is the giant impact model. And this is an example of what a giant impact might look like. This is Tempel 1. It's an asteroid struck by the Deep Impact mission. And you can see what happened was this small satellite-type object went out to the Tempel 1 and struck the asteroid with a small impactor and created this violent collision. The idea was to try and look at the composition of the asteroid through measuring the behavior and composition of materials through light, basically. And anyway, this is proposed to resolve the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system, and it can also resolve the chemical composition. What is the evidence for giant impact? Well, there's heavily cratered terrains on the moon. There's heavily created terrains on the Earth. We know that impact happens. It's a natural consequence of planetary growth. We can see the Barringer impact crater in Arizona. Even more impressive, the Vredefort structure in South Africa. There are big impact sites on the Earth. Now, of course, the Earth is undergoing constant renewal of its surface through erosion and plate tectonics. The Moon preserves 4.4 billion years of impact history. We know it happens. There are planetary oddities out there. The axes of nearly all the major planets are tilted. And the great example is Uranus, which is tilted almost completely on its side. And the only way you can really do this is by impacting it with a very large body, throwing it off its initial and original orbit. The slow backward rotation of Venus really is an oddity that could be explained by this process. And the huge core that Mercury has, that the Messenger mission is currently showing us, suggests that portions of Mercury were literally blown off by major collisions. Mercury is close to the Sun. It was probably a serious target. And computer simulations really back up all of this. This is a very basic 1D computer simulation done by AGW Cameron, and it shows what an impact between the Earth would look like and how it would accrete onto the Earth. And basically what he's showing here is two fully differentiated, two fully molten materials that are formed into a metal core and a silicate mantle colliding with one another, and what would happen to that material. And what you can see through these different stages is that the metal material, the core material of the impactor, which is known as Theia, because it's the goddess mother of Selene, the god of the moon, would go into the Earth, and that silicate material would be left to form the moon, just here, slide 16. So there's even more advanced computational models that suggest that this is a really viable hypothesis. But I wanted to show you this one because it's really the original, one of the original ones that shows it most elegantly. So the giant impact makes inherent sense. It's a hierarchy of scale. You start by aggregating dust to form the solar system, and things get bigger. You start making bigger and bigger planets. It's a runaway effect. And it's a stochastic effect in the sense that it happens without any rhyme or reason. You're colliding, you're undergoing Newtonian physics, you're colliding bodies in orbits and eccentricities, and the Sun is acting as the anchor, the tether for all of this. And so what you end up with is increasingly larger collisions towards the end of the formation of planets. And so we believe that this is a fundamental geological process in the formation of planets and the evolution of planets, as I'll hopefully show you now. So this explains the small core of the Moon. It also explains the density differences between the Earth and Moon. The Moon has a very large core, the Moon does not. It explains the angular momentum of the Moon and the disproportional size of the Moon, 1/80th the size of the Earth. And it provides a satisfactory method for completely melting the Moon to generate this layered structure that I've already discussed. So a question that we really need to address is, what is its timing, and can it explain the compositions of the Earth and Moon? This is where I'm going to show you some stuff from our lab. And unfortunately, they're XY plots, but I've only got two of them, so forgive me. This one is a very important one. This really shows you why we think the Earth and Moon formed together in a giant impact undergoing wholesale melting. What I'm showing you here is oxygen isotope compositions. On the x-axis is delta-18O. That's a plot of 18 oxygen over 16 oxygen. 16 oxygen is the major isotope of oxygen. And for those of you who don't know what an isotope is, an isotope is an element which is composed of protons with a different number of neutrons. And the number of neutrons defines the mass of the element, of the isotope. So isotope literally means same place in Greek, and that what we have are different masses for the different isotopes of different elements. So oxygen has three isotopes, 18, 17, and 16, 18 and 17 are very minor. As I say, 16 makes about 99% of all oxygen. But the ratios of these, relative to some standard, which in our case is standard mean ocean water, which is zero, tells us a great deal about a number of things, but most importantly about planet formation. And what we can also use is mass-independent fractionation of oxygen. That means to say that oxygen is not fractionating under the same processes. What we're recording here is early solar system heterogeneity of oxygen on the y-axis. And the terrestrial fractionation line, which is where all Earth rocks lie, is at zero. And what I've shown you here is the Mars fractionation line, the composition of Mars, which is about 0.3 per mil, 0.3 parts per thousand difference from the Earth. Various asteroidal materials. This is from the Howardite-Eucrite-Diogenite parent body, or Vesta, probably Vesta, the Angerite parent body. And what you can see here, and really the takeaway message here, is these are all lunar samples. And really the important thing to note, it doesn't really matter what these mean, they lie on the terrestrial fractionation line. This can immediately discount the co-accretion hypothesis and the capture hypothesis. It's very difficult to explain how you end up with bodies sitting right next to each other with identical compositions for oxygen unless they've mixed at some stage in their history. And this is really irrefutable geochemical evidence that the Earth and Moon have mixed at some stage in their history. Most likely through a giant impact, but actually the co-accretion hypothesis, the fission hypothesis could also work in this case. Here's some really recent data from work by my lab and also by a lab in St. Louis. And this is a very interesting story. The lead author on this, Randy Paniello, is one of the world's leading specialists in renewing tear ducts. He's a surgeon who in his spare time decided he would do a PhD in earth sciences. So he's quite a remarkable guy. What we did was we measured zinc isotope compositions in the Moon and compared them with materials from the Earth, from Mars, and from chondritic materials. Chondrites are what we think makes up the bulk composition of the solar system. They have an identical composition to the photosphere of the Sun. What we did was we measured these rocks from Mare basalts from the Moon. And what we found, once again, just like with oxygen, what we're showing here is we're showing differences, delta of differences, between 66 zinc and 64 zinc. And the takeaway message from this plot is that the Earth and Mars have identical compositions to chondrites. The Moon does not. This is much heavier. Heavier meaning that they have heavier mass isotopes, more of 68 and 66 than 64. What does that mean? Well, zinc, under the conditions of cosmic formation, is a volatile element. And what will happen during the formation and creation of planets under certain conditions, in the case of the Moon, is that zinc will actually begin to evaporate. And as it evaporates, things that evaporate preferentially are light isotopes. And what that will lead to is the Moon, or any other body for that matter, becoming heavier in these isotopes of zinc. So this very recent result has profound implications for the formation of the Moon. It shows that the Moon almost certainly went a huge high-temperature event in its history, as I've discussed. But it also shows that the Moon is volatile depleted. If it's depleted in zinc, it's almost certainly depleted in other volatiles, such as water. And so what we have is a fundamental dichotomy between the Moon and the Earth. It's again consistent with the impact between the Earth and Moon. And the big question is how the Earth has managed to gain its volatiles. And this is something we're working on right now. My student, Jasmeet Dhaliwal, is working on this problem. And also for understanding how Mars also has a volatile, rich composition based on its correspondence with chondritic meteorites. So this is a very important topic in geochemistry, and one that hopefully you'll hear a lot more about in the future. The timing of formation of the moon is based on radiometric dating techniques. This is actually not what we use to date the moon, but I quite like it. Carbon dating is only good for about tens of thousands of years. The moon, as it turns out, formed between about 150 million years after the solar system formed. And this is one of the least elegant parts of our current model, is understanding when the moon formed. It's extremely difficult to gain the timing. As we begin to focus down on the timing of the Earth and moon's formation, it opens more and more puzzles. But based on geochemical information, radiometric dating, and so on, we believe that the moon formed around 30 to 150 million years after the solar system formed. What this means is that the moon formed quite late. And that really requires a lot of heat, possibly through a giant impact. The moon has seen active volcanism for the last, for the first 1,500 million years of its history. For the last 3,000 million years, that's this number, it has been relatively inactive. That doesn't mean to say there hasn't been any geologic activity at all, but it's been relatively dead. And that contrasts with the Earth, where we've got active plate tectonics, we're breathing the atmosphere, which so kindly is generated by these processes. And so this remains a fundamental puzzle. Why is our twin, the moon, so dead and lifeless? And why are we blessed with life? So in summary, the moon can broadly be considered as having a geology consistent with a magma ocean. And that is consistent in itself with a giant impact late in the history of the moon. And that giant impact probably removed all or any volatiles from the moon. And the timing of this event is poorly constrained, but it probably occurred no later than 4.4 billion years ago. The solar system began at 4.568 billion years, and no earlier than 30 million years after the formation of the solar system. And with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention. Please. The gentleman asked, so did the evaporation that occurred on the moon to remove volatiles, why didn't it occur to the Earth? This is a fundamental question, and we have a number of hypotheses as to why this occurred. The first is actually aspects of the work that I do involved siderophile elements. These are elements that go into the metal, preferentially to silicates. These are important because they tell you about core formation. I didn't talk about this today. But what these show us is that the moon is also depleted in these elements. Now, these elements are not volatile. And the reason we argue that they are depleted is because the moon witnessed less accretionary material being added to it after its formation. There's a period of time, and in fact it's going on today, where you had accretion of material, addition of material, to the mantles of planetary bodies and crusts after the formation of their cores. This is happening today in the guise of meteorites and large impacts. It's an ongoing geologic process. What we think happened is that at the very beginning of the solar system, first 200 million years or so, there were enormous collisions going on. As planetary bodies got bigger and bigger, their orbits, those that were in unstable orbits, were beginning to get drawn into the sun, and some of those collided with the Earth and with the moon. And there's a focusing mechanism which is related to the size of the Earth and Moon that would lead to about 40 times as much material being added to the Earth as the Moon. So one hypothesis is that this brought volatiles to the Earth and not to the Moon. The other hypothesis is that there was some chemical behavior in the Earth that allowed it to retain volatiles while the Moon did not. Why would that happen? The moon is thought to have formed from the accretionary evaporative vapor disk from this huge event. The Earth is thought to have accreted most of the core material and a lot of the silicate material. It's 80 times bigger than the Moon. That could have allowed us to retain volatiles. And this is one of the major areas of research, both in our lab and globally, to try and understand when those volatiles were put into the Earth. It's critical, it's crucial, and it explains, hopefully will explain why we have our oceans and why we have as much as 27 times the amount of water that's in our current oceans in the mantle of the Earth today. At the back, hello. Excellent question. So the young gentleman in the back asked, did some of the craters that exist on the Moon today that we can see form during the giant impact? The answer to your question, in a sense, is yes, and in a sense is no. The Moon, when it formed with the Earth during either this giant impact between Earth and Theia, which was about the size probably of Mars, it would have completely melted the Earth, and it would have evaporated. It would have created a cloud, just like clouds we see in the atmosphere today, but of silicate material. It would have been extremely hot. You wouldn't have been able to walk around in your shorts. And so that event would have left a surface that was probably quite smooth. But in a sense, you're right, because that event was part of this late accretion, addition of material that's going on today. And so we think that, in fact, the impact craters on the Moon range from about 4.4 billion years ago to about, well, as young as very recently, Tycho crater, which is a large crater with a massive rays in the south part of the Moon, is thought to have formed about 100 million years ago. So in a sense, you're right, and in a sense, it's an ongoing process.
Well, James, I want to thank you very much for a fascinating talk, an excellent job, and thank you all for coming. Hope to see you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.